Money everywhere she goes. Yamazaki, straight from Tokyo. That's Beyonce. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. It was the fifth Yamazaki night of the season for the Blue Jays. Yes, despite a 3.26 ERA, they have only won five of Yusei Kikuchi's 14 starts. They won one on Tuesday, 3-0. Down in Milwaukee, evens this series up at 1-1, pulls them back within a game of 500 once again here. The rubber match goes down at 2:10 today. Chris Bassett against Tobias Myers. We'll set you up for that one throughout the show today. We have a loaded show, so a couple procedural notes here. We're going to have Eric Kratz on from Foul Territory in a little bit. We're going to plug more of that contest giveaway to potentially send you to Game 4 of the Stanley Cup Finals in Edmonton, and the Shania Twain concert that'll happen before that. We're going to talk to Blue Jays pitching prospect Adam Macko around 10:35. Ben Nicholson-Smith will join us at 11. And then around 11:30, we're going to ditch the baseball talk. Shawn Michaels, the Heartbreak Kid, is joining us. NXT and WWE have a big weekend of events coming up here in early July around the Money in the Bank premium live event. So we'll talk to him about that and his transition from one of the greatest in-ring performers of all time to one of the key figures backstage in how WWE finds and develops their next waves of talent. So that should all be pretty fun. Also pretty fun, Blue Jays won last night. Yusei Kikuchi got into trouble in the first, put two on with nobody out, managed to get out of it, got into trouble in the second, put two on with nobody out, managed to get out of it, got into trouble in the third, put two on with one out, managed to get out of it. He ends up pitching five shutout innings, three hits, four walks, five strikeouts, 15 swing and miss, a lot of good swing and miss stuff, and he needed it to get himself out of those jams. Now, some of those jams were assisted by Quinn Walcott, the home plate umpire, who weirdly, I say weirdly because we saw how he called the game last night, strike zone-wise, he is like a top five umpire in baseball in terms of ball strike accuracy over the last couple of seasons, which just goes to show you even the best umpires are sometimes shaky when it comes to that stuff, sometimes have an off night. Yusei Kikuchi obviously pitched around it effectively. He got out of there with five shutout innings. The Milwaukee Brewers as a team went 0 for 12 with runners in scoring position in the game. It did limit Yusei Kikuchi's length. He only went the five innings, of course, tallied up 97 pitches. So Nate Pearson did an inning. Chad Green did an inning. Trevor Richards got into some trouble but gave them two thirds. Jimmy Garcia comes in for a big, big four out save. On the hitting side, Jays managed to chip away at Carlos F. Rodriguez, who was making his major league debut. George Springer cashes one in the second. Spencer Horwitz cashes one in the fourth. And then in the ninth against Paredes, Danny Jansen came up with an RBI double there for a little insurance. The Jays went 5 of 12 with runners in scoring position. It's funny. I feel like a team could go like 11 for 12 with runners in scoring position. You'll remember the one time that they didn't come through. Jays did leave 9 on base, rather, and Vlad had a bit of a rough night in that regard, leaving a handful of runners out there in three different plate appearances. But you'll take the win. Two small notes related to the game. Kevin Kiermaier left in the seventh after fouling a ball off his knee. The team was calling it a right knee contusion. If he were to miss time here, Nathan Lucas is on the IL with the Buffalo Bison. So I think Addison Barger would probably be the next call up, given what the outfield looks like down at AAA, given who's on the 40-man and things like that. So we'll see how that progresses today. Jays, of course, have an off day tomorrow, so they could delay that decision, see how Kevin Kiermaier responds to a day or two off here. Kevin Biggio has officially been traded now. He got dealt. Ben Nicholson-Smith broke the news this morning. The Dodgers picked him up. Braden Fisher is coming back to the Blue Jays in this trade. He's a non-40-man relief prospect to split the year between AA and AAA. 23, mid-90s fastball, averages just below 93. It's hit as high as 96. But this is a guy who throws his curveball about 50% of the time. Makes sense. It's his best pitch by far based on like the pitch modeling metrics that we have, based on the results against it. Fastball is pretty pedestrian. The slider's not all that great results-wise. We'll see what the Jays can get out of him. We'll see to the extent to which he can throw that curveball effectively for the Buffalo Bisons. The Dodgers have one of the deepest farm systems in baseball. So they're like, the Jays had a top 31 prospects list at the start of the season on Fangraphs. They make that cutoff at who has a 40 value or higher on the 20 to 80 future value scale. The Dodgers had 49, and Fisher was only an honorable mention. So not a top 49 prospect in the Dodgers org, but it's someone back. It's extra bullpen depth for the Buffalo Bisons who need it. And yeah, maybe the Jays see something that they can continue to build on there. Yoriel Rodriguez made another start at AAA yesterday for that Bisons team. He went four innings, no earned runs, three hits and a walk, 10 strikeouts, threw 67 pitches, sat 92, 93, maxed out at 95. The fastball, the slider, the splitter all looked pretty good, all got some swing and miss. He's back. There's no need at this point, I don't think, for him to do any more rehab outings. The Jays will have that need. If they stay on turn, the need for the next bullpen day comes up Saturday. They could push that to Sunday if they wanted to. That would keep Yariel Rodriguez on a proper turn. They could also push it into the Red Sox series if they preferred to do that instead of the Guardians series. You can nitpick with that. That obviously costs you a day of rest for some of your starting pitchers if you have them all pitch on regular turn instead of getting that extra day of rest. So the case for that, I guess, would be that, you know, Cleveland is a better team overall. They're also a better hitting team than the Red Sox. Although some of that is how we adjust for field and things like that. The Red Sox OPS is almost identical to Cleveland. Also, this is one of those things where you're going to have to use it once in that set of games. You're going to have to use it once in the sixth set of games that follow the off day. So, you can get cued and pick your spots with it, and there's some value in that. But you're going to have to get through a bullpen day once at some point in that six-game set, and then you're going to have to get through a bullpen day a couple more times coming up because you don't have a fifth starter, which we'll talk about throughout the show. We'll talk to Ben Nicholson-Smith about that starting pitching depth, about the Kevin Biggio trade as well. And again, we're going to talk to Adam Macko in the second segment of the show. Waiting on Eric Kratz here to start the show up. Foul territory, of course. Three stints with the Toronto Blue Jays, which is kind of fun. He was originally drafted by the Blue Jays in the 29th round back in 2002, then ended up back with the team in 2014, spent only 34 games with them after being acquired, got dealt again, was back in the org as a minor leaguer in 2016, and then, continued on from there. Really good guy, really good guest. We don't have him right now, so we're going to answer a couple of your texts in the text line. Darren in Paris asks, why is Bo hitting fourth when he's hitting 234? The answer here is that they don't have a lot of good options. Like every day, one of the texts in the text line, and I'm not speaking negatively of the text. They're reasonable questions. But every day, one of the texts in the text line is inevitably about, well, what about this in the batting order? Why is this the case in the batting order? The Blue Jays don't have enough good hitters to fill out a lineup card at the top of the order that looks like a good lineup card. Right now, your options in the top two spots in the order have been Davis Schneider, Spencer Horwitz, and Danny Jansen. Danny Jansen is only playing two out of every 3 days and has cooled off dramatically last night's big insurance run aside. Davis Schneider is in an 0-for-17 stretch and is in arguably the worst month of his career right now. Those two guys got bumped up because the guys who were hitting in those spots were underperforming. George Springer has hit a little bit better since sliding down in the order, still has a 291 OBP and a 591 OPS on the year. Justin Turner has crawled back to almost league average at the plate, and that's heavily influenced by platoon splits. He's crushing lefties and still not hitting righties all that well. You could slide Daniel Vogelbach in there for process and because of the potential there. Guess what? He has one home run on the year and has a 577 OPS. The answer to why Bo is hitting fourth is they don't have enough good hitters to fill out the top of a lineup card. Like Spencer Horwitz just got called up from AAA and is leading off and probably makes the most sense as a leadoff guy for this team. You could juggle around. You could put Dalton Varsho in that spot, although when he got jumped in the order earlier, he cooled off a little bit. And I'm not saying those things are related. I'm just saying, again, they don't have enough good hitters to have an ideal looking lineup. Yes, ideally, I think, you know, Davis Schneider probably moves down and slides into one of those kind of power alley spots, run producing spots. So maybe your top five looks something like, you know, Horwitz, Vlad, Schneider, Varsho, and Jansen when he's in there in some order at the five and Bo slides down to six. But again, you don't have enough hitters who are performing well right now. So that's a tough one there. Bob in Scarborough asks for my favorite Kevin Biggio memory. Honestly, probably how he looked in the all white uniforms that they trotted out. The one point he suited them in a weird way. But no, Kevin Biggio, look, I like Kevin Biggio a lot as a player. I hope he's going to have some success with the Dodgers here. The Dodgers are a team that generally has done really well in terms of these transactions at the margins. you know, the Jays have the reasons for moving on from Gavin Biggio. I don't think he's going to go to the Dodgers and slot in between Mookie Betts and Shohei Ohtani in the batting order and suddenly be an all-star. But I think he's a useful player. And I thought that, you know, when he wasn't playing a lot, I thought that when they designated him for assignment, I understand it. But yeah, the fact that a team like the Dodgers put their hand up and was like, hey, we'll take him for, you know, an org depth kind of pitcher, I think tells you something. Now, you look at what his potential role is with the Dodgers, and it gets interesting because what are the positions Gavin Biggio backs up? Right field. Well, Jason Hayward platoons in that spot, and he's a lefty. He only plays against righties. Maybe some second base. Gavin Lux has had a bit of a rough year, but he's a lefty who plays second base most days for that team as well. First base, Freddie Freeman doesn't take days off, and he's a lefty who plays there. The DH spot is not open because Shohei Ohtani's in there every day. Maybe you look at third base where Enrique Hernandez has played there for the most part. Miguel Rojas has kind of been the guy backing up at third and second and hasn't had, you know, hasn't been particularly effective. Their bench as currently constructed is all righties, and they really haven't leaned on it much. Between Rojas, Chris Taylor, and Miguel Vargas, they very rarely go to the bench. So maybe they just want someone with a little more utility. Hey, there's some potential defensive value. If we pinch hit for Hayward when a lefty comes in, someone else who can fill in right field. Enrique Hernandez needs a day off, and we want a lefty in there instead of Miguel Rojas. Here you go. Someone with some pinch running utility off the bench. There you go. So I know this is not answering your question in terms of my favorite Gavin Biggio memory as a Blue Jay, but yeah, taking a look at what his next stop in LA looks like. That's kind of what it looks like. And again, Braden Fisher, somewhat interesting prospect coming back in this one. Heavy curveball guy, a guy who has a rough numbers at AAA this year. Is a 6.94 ERA in 12 innings at AAA, across AA and AAA this year. Big strikeout numbers, but big walk numbers. So that's kind of what you're looking at there with him. Last year, he did basically the full season at AA through 61 innings out of the bullpen. So that's encouraging there. You know, oftentimes with these relief pitchers, you're not sure about the workload. You're not sure about their ability to go out there and pitch 40, 50 times. He had a 2.95 ERA. Again, that was AA. He walked too many guys, but you can squint and see why the Blue Jays would see this guy as bullpen depth for the farm. I don't think he's in the major league mix imminently here or anything like that. You can keep your text coming to 590-590. Doesn't look like we're going to get Eric Kratz here after all. So send us those. We'll do a text segment here today. And again, we got Adam Macko and Ben Nicholson-Smith coming on a little later. Mike in Halifax asks, what would it take for George Springer to move back into the leadoff spot? I think probably a combination of Springer's got to continue hitting a little better, and then the guys who are at the top now have to, you know, show that they can't handle it. Now, Davis Schneider's an interesting one where, you know, John Schneider spoke yesterday about how he's maybe a little tired. He's just missing on a lot of pitches. I broke down on Blue Jay Central last night that, you know, one of the things that pitchers have done differently with Davis Schneider this year is they have, you know, when he first came in, the book was, oh, we got to challenge him high and hard and give him the velocity high and inside. He showed he could handle that at least capably. Pitchers went to other paths. He showed he could hammer breaking balls. You know, still hasn't been awesome with off-speed stuff, but not a lot of pitchers have terrific off-speed stuff, so it doesn't come up as much. So now what we're seeing is he hasn't faced this rate of fastballs at any point in his career. Even when he first came up, he's seeing more fastballs, sinkers, cutters now. And the interesting thing is pitchers are concentrating those on the outer third of the plate more than they ever have against him. So now the challenge for him is, hey, can you cover the whole plate? We know you can turn around on something and pull it. Can you take some the other way? Can you adjust your swing to be able to pull those outside pitches? So this question was about George Springer, not about Davis Schneider, but it is worth noting that John Schneider said yesterday, yeah, he's working on it here, and it's something that they're aware of, and they got him another day down yesterday. So that's part of it. Maybe Davis Schneider stays cool and they want to get him back down. Even if Davis Schneider is hitting well, if George Springer were to hit well, I like Davis Schneider in like a 4-5 six spot. You know, Danny Jansen has cooled off here as well and obviously isn't in the lineup every day. So that's one component of it. The guys who are there have to come down. The other component is George Springer has to play well. And since he moved down in the order back on May 18th, that's 21 games. He's looked a little better, but we're lowering the bar here pretty much. He has a 662 OPS during that stretch. You know, hitting only .214. He's got two home runs in that stretch, but that's not as much power production as you would have liked to see from him in the slide down. So, I don't know. It's a little hard to see the case for George Springer going back up in the lineup, especially, you know, I think he's got two hits in the last week. So Yeah, it's something that they will look at again eventually. Like last year, George Springer's time down in the order lasted about a month. And then when Whit Merrifield cooled off dramatically, they popped George Springer back up to the top of the order there. He has not hit well enough necessarily to justify that yet. So thank you for that question. Andrew from Kitchener asks, do I think they're waiting until the trade deadline to slot Votto into the lineup? No, I think they are waiting for Joey Votto's ankle to heal and Joey Votto to get back in games. He still hasn't even played in minor league games yet. We're talking about he's doing T work. He's doing some defensive drills and some running. But at our last update, which I think was last week, he's not even in game action down at the complex yet. So I don't think this is an intentional they're waiting. I think if the plan was to have him in the lineup after the trade deadline, they'd still want him in the minor leagues, getting some hacks in right now, getting some plate appearances to make sure he's ready for that. So I think this is a this is very much his ankle is lingering in a way that they maybe didn't anticipate and it's taking longer than they expected. Ed and Aurelia asks, how about IKF in the four hole? No. Look, I have time for it when people have asked about IKF moving up in the order because he's hit so well. He's had such a nice season so far for this team. The concern with that is, you know, hey, he has a, even in a nice season, he has a .313 on base percentage, so he's not getting on base a ton. In terms of the cleanup spot, there's just not enough, you know, power potential there. Like he has four home runs right now. His career high is 8. His career high in RBI is 53. You know, this isn't a guy, again, he's off to a really nice start to this season. I don't think you want to overreact to that too much. Like when we say he's off to a nice start to this season, he's been a league average hitter. I think he's comfortable in the bottom of the order. I personally like hitter types like IKF toward the bottom of the order to reset, you know, when things turn around. I know he'll get a few less plate appearances being 7-8-9 than he would in say the 2 spot or the 4 spot. But I like a guy like that who has good contact skill, who has some good situational hitting as that lineup rolls back over for your top guys. So no, I don't think he's moving up to the top half of that lineup, particularly in the four hole. Ed and Aurelia also asked, what happens to balls in the dirt the catcher throws at a play? Do they get mixed in with the others and get put back in play? They do not. Those become batting practice balls then afterward. So there is a huge, huge inventory of balls that all the teams have. They get mucked up with that particular type of Delaware River mud is, I believe, the specific mud that they muck them up with so that the balls aren't completely fresh off the production line. But once they enter circulation into gameplay, then they become batting practice balls. And then I don't know what the life cycle is beyond that. I imagine they get like donated to like youth camps and stuff like that once their life as a batting practice ball is done, because I don't think you recycle the materials or anything like that. Kevin from Toronto asked, why did it take them so long to make the Horwitz-Biggio decision? They clearly think Horwitz is a better hitter, yet they waited so long. I don't fully understand the process. Kevin, it's a very reasonable question. I think part of it was, you know, there's an urgency from a winning standpoint. There's not necessarily as much of an urgency for them from a transaction standpoint. It's not as if Spencer Horwitz can become a free agent today. You know, maybe the old Dan Shulmanism, these things have a way of working themselves out. And hey, wouldn't you know, if Kevin Kiermaier fouls a ball off his knee yesterday, maybe that would have been an opportunity for Horwitz to come up. I'm not saying you don't make the move because you assume an injury is going to happen, but if there's not, you know, the urgency to win is real, the urgency to make that transaction from a pure flexibility standpoint, sometimes it can make sense to wait. I agree with you. They probably waited a little long for that. That's why we had Spencer Horwitz on the show. That's why we had Pat Malacaro from the Bisons on the show the day that I had an inkling Spencer Horwitz might be getting called up. Part of it is also they may have been trying to find a trade for Kevin Biggio, trying to find a trade for, I don't know, Daniel Vogelbach, anyone really, just to kind of canvas the league and see what's out there. Obviously, this Kevin Biggio trade is not a blockbuster or anything like that. But yeah, they probably also were honestly a little torn on who to have as the odd man out. Ernie Clement for the defense and base running value, Daniel Vogelbach for that kind of more threatening, at least bench profile as a pinch hitter / occasional DH, or Kevin Biggio, who kind of splits the difference, has some defensive versatility, but isn't as dangerous as at the bat, isn't quite the defender Ernie Clement is in the infield spots. And I wonder too, if part of it was Daniel Vogelbach had been so shaky to start the season, but had so many of those underlying indicators over the last couple of weeks that, hey, it was coming around, really long plate appearances, hitting the heck out of the ball, his OPS over the last couple of weeks have been much better, et cetera. If they were just maybe waiting to see if they believed that that was a change for Vogelbach and if he had kind of turned a corner. I guess the one other consideration would be they didn't want to call Spencer Horwitz up and have him play second base, having only played it three or four times, and the extra couple weeks in AAA allowed him to get a couple of extra appearances down there. Question from someone who didn't sign there. How infuriating is it that the Jays gave up Espinal for a bag of balls before the season started to have the Biggio job, and now he's gone? I always read the Espinal one as more of a Ernie Clement took his spot than Kevin Biggio did. I also think it's probably worth going over to Cincinnati and taking a look at Santiago Espinal's season before you get too upset about it. He has appeared in 47 games for the Reds. He's hitting 198 with an OPS of 543, and his defense has graded out as below average. I know there's some versatility there. Look, back in 2022, the season that he showed a little bit more pop early in the season, you know, I bet on that. I went back to some of the spring training stuff he had done, some of the late season changes, you know, the muscle he'd added. I thought maybe that was going to be a better version of Santiago Espinal long term. I bid on that pump fake, so I get it. I get wanting to see that out. But he has not been a good major leaguer for the Cincinnati Reds so far this season, and he's now in kind of a pretty set bench and kind of pinch hit slash utility role for them. He's played twice in the last week for them. So I wouldn't call it infuriating. Between Clement, Biggio, and Espinal, you know, I don't know. They cleared up the money with Espinal to keep Clement on the roster and be able to keep Daniel Vogelbach. I get it. Kevin Biggio always seemed a little further ahead on the depth chart than those guys. The season's just gone as it has for him. Phil in Oshawa asks, Kirk has been hitting better lately. Has anything changed or just a hot streak? Yeah, not to plug our own content, but I would go back to yesterday's show and listen a little bit to Joe Siddle talking about just that. He went into some of the mechanical changes that he's seeing from Kirk right now. So yeah, it's encouraging. You know, Joe can speak to the swing mechanic stuff better than I can. The process has always been there with Alejandro Kirk, you know, working a good at-bat. It's just you need to see him do a little bit of damage. And in Joe's estimation, that swing is coming around to where, yeah, maybe there's going to be a little more consistent damage coming out of it, which is good because I do think probably part of why Danny Jansen has fallen off a little bit at the plate is that he's been playing so much. So it's always better for a team that has two catchers like this if they can kind of get closer to a split time and they're both hitting a little bit. That benefits everyone. Steve from Markham asks, have the Jays not learned their lesson about trading to a West Division team for a prospect named Fisher? Apparently not. Although I would say that Braden Fisher is probably, we should probably frame him more as org depth than a prospect. Again, he wasn't in the top 49 Dodgers prospects. And that's a lot of prospects. That speaks to the depth of the Dodgers system, that's how Fangraphs wrote it up. But it is a, he's a relief pitcher. He's 23. He was a fourth round pick 4 or 5 years ago now. But this is org depth relief pitching. Howard in Thornhill says, need a power hitter, any trades you can imagine. Let's put a pin in that one because I think we're going to talk to Ben Nicholson-Smith about it at 11 o'clock. Amit in the control room asks, where does Shawn Michaels rank among my favorite wrestlers of all time? Who's on the top? Well, this is what's hard about it, Amit, is that Bret the Hitman Hart is at the top of it. And obviously there is a friction between Bret the Hitman Hart and the Harper Kid Shawn Michaels historically. We will say that now. We won't say that on air at 11:30 when Shawn Michaels joins us. What we'll say on air at 11:30 when Shawn Michaels joins us is he's all of our favorite wrestlers of all time, and we're stoked to have him. We are stoked to have him. We'll talk about NXT and WWE with him at 11:30. Probably not much baseball, though. John from Toronto asks, if the Jays are two games behind the last wild card in the last week of July, trade deadline upcoming, what should they do? Who would be the ideal player and players at it? Again, we're going to talk about this a little bit with Ben Nicholson-Smith. We're going to talk about ideal targets and things like that in July. Not, you know, on June 12th, we're still trying to figure out if this team is good enough to even warrant adding. But I think, you know, the type of player is going to be pretty straightforward. Their positional versatility, the way they're built, allows them some flexibility in, hey, do you want to add a left fielder, a third baseman, a second baseman? You could address any of those spots, a fourth outfielder who hits right-handed. You can go a couple different ways there. But for me, the biggest thing is going to be they've got to add someone with power. And then obviously bullpen. Every team, even the very best teams, need extra bullpen arms. And this Jays bullpen has been toward the bottom of the league. But yeah, you're gonna be looking at power. As for your question about what should they do if they're two games out at the end of July, I think if they're that close, they're going to go for it. It's, you know, in terms of should, that kind of depends how you feel about the value of just getting into the playoffs at a time when playoff series, especially those best two out of three first rounds, feel pretty random. You know, is that worth it? Is it worth it for that kind of 50-50 chance to go on a little bit of a run, make the ALDS and things like that? That's probably more personal preference, but I am fairly certain that if they're only two games out at the deadline, they would not be selling. That is probably close enough for them that they ride it out and try to make this playoff push the last little bit here. Someone who did not sign there says, I'm a Biggio fan and was hoping he would go somewhere where he would play every day and show his stuff. Will he play a lot in LA? Kind of broke this down a little earlier. Probably not a lot. He, again, at right field, second base, and first base, three of the positions he played, and DH, they have lefties who are in there pretty much every day. Now, Gavin Lux hasn't played super well. Maybe that usage could come down a little bit, but if you're looking for platoon opportunities, his best path to playing time is probably a share of third base, where Enrique Hernandez plays for the most part, and he kind of can slot into the Miguel Rojas, Chris Taylor, Miguel Vargas rotation as bench guys. The Dodgers do not use their bench a lot because they have, you know, eight or nine really good starters, but they obviously see him as an upgrade on one of their guys there. It's also worth noting that it sounds like Max Muncy, who would eat the lion's share as another lefty in that lineup, that he's not progressing as fast as he would like from his oblique strain. That is a quote from him yesterday on Foul Territory. So maybe this is insurance for that as well. Hey, Max Muncy's out a little longer than we thought. That's a guy we figured would play some third base. We'd like Enrique Hernandez more in a super sub role. So Kevin Biggio slots in there. Probably play a little bit more than he was playing with Toronto the last couple weeks. But yeah, I don't think he's taken, you know, playing time from Otani or Freeman. And then even Hayward and Lux, again, haven't been like unbelievable, but they're lefties. And I don't know, you know, platoons aren't as simple as left versus left, right versus right anymore. But I think this is probably a move to address third base depth and improve the quality of their bench there. Okay, we're going to take a break here. Sorry we didn't get Eric Kratz after all, but thank you for the text. You can always keep those coming, 2590-590. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to one of the highest, fastest rising prospects in the Toronto Blue Jays system, Adam Macko, who was the other piece of the return in the Teoscar Hernandez for Eric Swanson trade. Took a little bit of time to find his footing in the Blue Jays organization last year, around midseason, maybe early August, more so than midseason. Things kind of started to click for him. The numbers turned around. The strikeouts went up. He started to look like the prospect the Blue Jays had envisioned when they traded for him. They added him to the 40-man roster in the offseason to make sure he was protected from the Rule 5 draft. He is now probably the biggest pitching success story in the farm system. He has a 360 ERA over 11 starts at AA. He's striking out more than 30% of the batters he faces. The walk rate is down. He's been able to stay healthy, which was a challenge for him earlier in his pro career. He has a fascinating backstory. He's also a pseudo-Canadian. He moved to Canada when he was, 14 and grew up, you know, played his formative baseball years in Alberta. So we're going to take a break. We're going to talk to Adam Macko all about that backstory and what's going right for him with the New Hampshire Fisher Cats down at AA this year. Before we do that, though, Rogers has announced an exciting new national contest, Bring Stanley Home, to send Rogers customers and hockey fans from across Canada to the Stanley Cup Final in Edmonton. Rogers customers have the chance to win 10 VIP trips for two to attend Game 4 in Edmonton on Saturday, June 15th. That prize also includes travel and accommodation, plus premium viewing at a game day concert featuring Shania Twain outside of Rogers Place. Visit rogers.com/Stanley Cup to enter for your chance to win. And for more details, again, travel and accommodations, Game 4 Oilers Panthers in Edmonton, and Shania Twain pregame concert at Rogers Place. rogers.com/Stanley Cup. For more information, let's take a break. Adam Macko joins us on the other side.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The JD Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jay's Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Been a morning already. Jays win 3-0. Even this series up at 1-1. They will look to win the series today at 2:10. Chris Bassett against Tobias Myers. Yeah, it's an afternoon game, so make sure you're tuned into Sportsnet and the Sportsnet Radio Network nice and early. Right now, we're going to go down to the farm. We're going to go to New Hampshire and the Fisher Cats. We're joined now by one of the fastest rising and best seasons so far for any Blue Jays pitching prospect, any Blue Jays prospect whatsoever. It's Adam Macko. Adam, good morning, man. Thanks for doing this.
Good morning. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So strong start to the season for you so far, man. I know last year things kind of seemed to click for you middle to late middle of last year. What do you think it has been at the heart of kind of you being able to pick up some momentum like this the last maybe calendar year?
Yeah, no, there's definitely a lot of things that I think play a role, but I think the main thing is just me getting away from focusing on bettering my mechanics and changing all that since I've been doing that for a long time now and just focusing on my next lowest hanging fruit, which is probably the mental game and being able to stay sharp every single pitch throughout my outing.
So how big a challenge has that been for you? I know you talked to Shai Davidi about this a little bit last year, not tinkering and not changing your mechanics. You know, hey, if there's one game where you have a bad outing or something doesn't feel good, you know, one day, trusting the larger process and the work you're doing instead of trying to find a fix for it, you know, immediately every time.
Yeah, no, it's definitely been difficult for me at the beginning. I think now is just more so me believing in myself more than believing in my mechanics and changing that belief system into something that's a little bit more concrete. And yeah, like you said, when a game doesn't go well, I don't always blame it on mechanics and try to change it all over again. It's just looking at the bigger picture and looking at the different things that I may not have paid attention to before.
So when you talk about working on the mental side of your game, what goes into that for you? Are you like a meditation and visualization guy? Is it just a lot of, you know, thinking through pitch sequencing and stuff like that? What is the mental side mean to you?
Yeah, it's kind of all of the above. I'm definitely a big meditation visualization type of guy, day before outing, in between outings, whenever possible. And it is for me literally just being able to be locked in on every pitch. In the past, it's been kind of like four or five pitches go by and then I kind of catch myself, be like, oh wait, like I gotta get back in the zone here a little bit. But yeah, I've had lots of great help from the Blue Jays with that, and I think me just paying attention to that a little bit more of every time I go out there for my next inning, it's just that one inning that I'm pitching. I don't think of throwing hopefully six innings. I'd think of throwing one inning six times, if that makes sense. And doing that and doing the same thing with every single pitch as well. It's just that one pitch and being able to be locked in on that is super important.
Yeah, and that does make sense, that way of phrasing it. I like that a lot, though. Throw one inning six times. And look, the results are very good. Obviously, you've been going longer into games. I know you spoke at the end of last season about, you know, a focus of this offseason was going to be the strength and making sure, you know, you could stay healthy and stay on the mound. What's gone into that? Like, what did your offseason look like in terms of a prepping for a full workload this year?
Yeah, it was similar to my other off seasons, but just paying a little bit more attention to detail. And like I said, it's a lot of it. Me just trusting my process and being able to now move on to like the mental stuff. So being locked in, even when I'm in the off season, throwing in a cage by myself, sometimes it's just being able to be locked in on everything that I'm doing and have a purpose behind everything. And the fact that I was able to do that a little bit better this off season has helped me a great deal.
I know also, you know, in recent games, you've been going a little longer. You maybe weren't doing the every fifth day. It was more like every sixth day to start the year, and your outings have gotten a little bit longer. Was that part of, you know, the larger plan for you? Is that just because things have been going well? Hey, let's push it a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's kind of as the season goes on, we get a little bit more leeway. And as our arms build up, it's a little bit safer to go a little bit longer. I've done one 5-day rotation. I've been on a 6-day ever since then. I'll have another one in a couple of weeks. But yeah, I feel great doing both. I think having 7 days last year in between outings was nice for the arm, but it was also mentally like you don't check out, but you know you have a long time before you pitch, and that one day seems to make a big difference in how it feels in between outings. So now that I'm on 6 or 5 day, like it feels like I get to pitch more often, which is great.
Yeah, that sounds it sounds like more fun. But yeah, I guess the arm side of it is the biggest concern. Adam, this is maybe a question I should have asked with respect to the mental side of the game, but you're having some success The numbers are really strong. The reports coming out from all the scouting people are really strong. Do you let yourself think about, hey, next steps, you know, maybe there's AAA later in this year. Hey, you know, the Jays have some injuries, et cetera. And if you don't think about that, what is that process like for you to make sure that you're just focused on your work start to start?
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking of being in the big league since I was 12 years old. So nothing changes in that. But I think for me, just being able to stick to what got me here and what has given me success, which is not really thinking about the next steps, not really thinking about the things that I can't control, which is whether I move up to AAA or whatever it may be. Me just really dialing in on what got me here, because it's a tough game. And if you start thinking ahead of the game and you try to kind of play GM and do all that, it doesn't tend to work out for people. So I want to stick to what I've been doing, stick to my lane, and let the people that get paid a lot of money to do that to figure it out.
That's probably the best approach. Like you said, since you were 12 years old, you've been thinking about playing in the big leagues. I remember reading a quote from you back when you were playing like for the Alberta provincial team or something, that hey, the goal is to be a Hall of Famer that young. But for those who don't know, your path to baseball has been a little unlikely, because you grew up in Slovakia until you were about 12, and then moved to Ireland for a couple years, then landed in Alberta, and that's kind of when it took off. Can you walk us through, for anyone who hasn't heard your story in that regard, can you walk us through a little bit about, you know, your background growing up and then where baseball factored into that?
Yeah, so I was born in Slovakia. Baseball started for me very early, considering where I'm from. It was very lucky. It was the only extracurricular activity, I think, in Slovakia that provided baseball. So it was my first day of grade one. There were tryouts. We're hitting ball pit balls into a net. We were playing fetch. We didn't know where the ball was going, but it was just friends having fun, and it was free. So we're like, you know what, why not? Like, it doesn't hurt anything. So we signed up. We had no idea what it was. Our parents had no idea what it was. But as my love for the game started to grow a little bit, my parents got into it more as well. And now they're still learning, and they know a lot more than they did back then now. And so once I was playing baseball for a couple of years, we moved to Ireland in 2011. We stayed there for about 16 months. The baseball there was similar to Slovakia. It was, maybe the community was a little bit better at that time. I know in Slovakia now the community has developed a lot since I've left. But Ireland was a lot of fun. We had a lot of great memories there. We lived there for 16 months. Like I said, in 2013, we moved to Canada in August. And then, it kind of blew me away, the amount of baseball that was there and the amount of talent that was there. But I was lucky enough to be able to compete with everybody, and that kind of got me moving through the ranks a little bit and got to Vauxhall.
I know you have you've spoken about as well, kind of teaching yourself more pitching stuff from watching a lot of YouTube videos, you know, Googling who's the best pitcher and checking out their videos. So I know names that have come up are like Chris Sale, David Price. Are there pitchers in the majors now that you still watch and try to pick things from, or even just like really enjoy watching?
Yeah, there's a bunch of them. It's kind of a mixed bag. I think right now for me, recently I've been watching Tyler Glasnow. He's been dealing. I always like to watch old Jacob deGrom games, Blake Snell. Still watch Justin Verlander. He's kind of been like the first guy that I got into, so gotta stay true to him. David Price was a guy that I watched a lot, loved when he was on the Blue Jays. It kind of mixes. Anytime somebody has a really good outing, I like to watch that, see what they're doing, see what happened. And
You mentioned Price on the Blue Jays. I imagine, you know, there's not a team that Slovakians naturally root for. When you ended up in Alberta, did you become like, were you a Jays fan from that point because you were in Canada, or are you kind of just a fan of players?
Yeah, definitely. Once we moved to Canada, I became a Jays fan. I didn't really watch any MLB baseball or any baseball at all before that, really. I didn't even know that such league as MLB existed. But once we got to Canada, I went out to eat somewhere, and they had the Blue Jays game on the TV in the restaurant. And ever since then, me and my family have just been kind of rooting for the Jays.
So can you take me back a little bit to, you know, two off seasons ago now, you get the call, and I know you missed the call, but then you get the call eventually that you've been traded. What that was like kind of, you know, emotionally for you. Obviously you had been with the Mariners organization, that's all you knew, but then it kind of comes out that, yeah, by the way, you're going to the Toronto Blue Jays organization. What was that kind of whirlwind like for you?
Yeah, it was definitely a whirlwind. Like you said, it was early morning. I didn't really think much of the call that I was getting. For me, it was a couple of days after I got back from the fall league, just trying to get back into the swing of things at home. And yeah, once I got the text from Andy McKay, they're like, hey, call me back as soon as possible. I kind of had a hunch that that's what it might have been. I know a lot of players that have gone to the fall league have been traded afterwards, but I didn't want that to be true. But once I got on the phone with him and he's like, said some really nice words, said goodbye, said like, you've been traded to the Toronto Blue Jays. And I was like, oh, like, okay, like not so bad. Like, could be a lot worse. That was definitely a team that, like, when I first was scheduled to be drafted, it was either the Mariners or the Blue Jays for me. So the fact that I got to experience both and that I went to the Blue Jays, I was like, okay, made the blow a little bit easier, because I did love being with the Mariners. They're a great organization. But yeah, as soon as I got off the phone with him, I got a call from a couple people from the Blue Jays, and immediately they were really excited to have me. I was blown away by the amount of attention and detail that they had, and the stuff that they knew about me, and the welcoming nature of everybody. And once I got to the complex, and the complex being second to none, I got lost in there for the first 3 days I was there. Couldn't find my way around. But yeah, everybody was, and the people were even better. Everybody was super welcoming and already had a plan for me, which is amazing, and I'm grateful for it now. I don't think I could be in a better spot.
And you got to pitch all of last year in Vancouver, where I imagine it was a little easier for your family to come see you.
Yeah, absolutely. It was only a short flight away, a little bit longer of a drive through the Rockies, but they made the flight out a couple of times, and I got to stay at home with my girlfriend. She lived like 45 minutes away from the field, so I got to drive back and see my dog, see my girlfriend every day, which was amazing. Something I've never had in baseball before is having that kind of like the off-season life that I would have with my family and friends, and connect that with like my in-season baseball. It was an amazing experience, and I was extremely happy to have that.
In terms of individual games that you've pitched in your career so far, that game one of the Northwest Championship League final last year, and you're against your former team and you throw five shutout innings, where does that rank for you in terms of like, hey, individual days or performances you remember?
Yeah, that was definitely up there. I couldn't remember the last time that I was playing in like a game where it was either playoffs or finals or anything like that. So getting to experience that was amazing. Getting the game one, I don't think I've ever had before, which was something new for me, and I really wanted to deliver. And it was definitely a full circle moment for me once I realized it was going to be in Everett, where I played before. It was going to be obviously against Everett and my old team, and now I get to compete against them, and yeah, it was quite the moment. Definitely ranks up there.
All right, I got a couple more personal ones for you to round out here. So obviously you grew up in Slovakia. How much is the Slovakian heritage like still a part of the family life? Like, are you guys bumping Slovakian music at family events and stuff like that? How much is that culture still a part of you guys and your family?
Oh, the culture's still running strong. We're definitely, when we're at home, we talk nothing but Slovakian, maybe a little bit of English with my younger sister, but just Slovakian when we can. And we're still definitely bumping the Slovakian tunes. They got me downloading a couple for myself. So I still, when I shuffle my library, I still get a couple of Slovakians in there, nice little Easter eggs.
Nice. So when you first came over, and I know you would have, you know, started picking up English a little bit in Ireland, how much did baseball help you, like socializing and making friends and stuff like that, given that, you know, you weren't as fluent in English when you first came over?
Yeah, no, baseball was absolutely huge for me. Just getting into a country that I've obviously never been to before, not understanding any of the language. It was really hard for me. I was really social when I was in Slovakia, and so going from that to not being able to speak to anybody was definitely a little bit of a blow. But yeah, baseball was everything for me. As soon as I got to the field, for my first kind of practice, it was something amazing that I experienced there. Everybody was like super welcoming. Everybody was excited for me to be there, and they couldn't have been better at helping me through understanding the lingo and getting like feeling like a part of a team. You know, it's kind of a universal language. So once you start get on that field, that's all that matters. You throw the ball, you hit it, you catch it, you do all those things, and you have fun doing it. And we had a lot of fun doing it in Ireland.
In terms of the lingo and the culture around baseball and stuff like that, you're a big baseball movie guy too, right? Like the Major Leagues and Bull Durham and movies like that.
Absolutely. That's how I learned English over the summer break.
Nice. Do you have a favorite like from that, like baseball? It doesn't have to be a baseball movie, but like of movies like that helped you pick up English.
Hard to pick a favorite. My dad's absolute favorite is Moneyball.
Okay.
So that one always jumps out to me. We like watching that one. But Bull Durham's hilarious. I like watching Bull Durham. Like you said, Major Leagues. What other one? I like Mr. Baseball. I thought that was kind of a different one for me, and it was cool. There was
League of Their Own is the one with the women's league.
With the women's, we watched that one too. Yes, there's one of like Norway high school or Norway college of like them of this coach coming in and trying to keep their like perfect season going, and that was like their last season they were going to play baseball. I forget the name of that movie, but that was a good one too. They always, the big thing in that movie was they were like crisp on the in and outs around the infield and never made an error and played really good, which was, that was cool. I can't think of much more off the top of my head, but
that's a good list though.
A lot of them that we watched.
Yeah, that's a good list. Okay, I remember hearing you on a podcast a couple years ago. You said you'd never been to a concert. This was like, I don't know, the start of last season. Have you fixed that yet? Like, have you been to a concert now?
No, not yet.
Damn. What's top of the list? Like, what's your target for Adam Mackle's first concert?
First concert? That's a good one. Recently, I've been listening a lot of Milky Chance. I think that'd be great to see in a concert. The Weeknd has been kind of, since I got to Canada, has been kind of consistently in my library. There's a lot of people I won't get to watch, unfortunately, in a concert, but Post Malone, The Weeknd, Milky Chance, honestly, just any. Like, I would just love to go to any concert. Just haven't seemed to find the time yet.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be tough a little bit with the baseball schedule, obviously, and then you're in New Hampshire most of the time now. But hey, if you make it to Toronto at some point, there are off days, there are Sunday afternoon games, there's a concert here every day, man. You're going to have that opportunity soon.
Yeah, hopefully that'd be great.
Adam, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Keep up the great work. Rooting for you the rest of the season.
Really appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Adam Mackle, pitcher for the New Hampshire Fisher Cats. And yeah, on the radar for the Blue Jays right now, because obviously there is a big hole in that fifth starter spot. They're filling it with Bowden Francis right now. Trevor Richards led bullpen day. Yariel Rodriguez had another really good rehab outing yesterday. But if you look longer term, I mean, Yusei Kikuchi is a free agent. Alek Manoah is going to be injured well into next year as he rehabs from the surgery that he's going to get this coming Monday. Adam Mackle's on the 40, man. He's pitching very, very well at Double A, and things are continuing to trend in the right direction. You know, talk to some people in the organization, talk to some unbiased scouts from outside of the organization. Everyone seems to think things are clicking for Adam Mackle. Maybe we see him at Triple A sooner than later. Maybe we see him in the majors in the not too distant future. We're going to take a break here in a minute. We're going to talk to Ben Nicholson-Smith on the other side. Take a look at this Kevin Biggio trade to the Dodgers. Take a look at, hey, the Jays are a game back of 500 and only two games out of the wild card. And by the way, we did the, like, last week we were doing the, oh, they're two or three games out of the wild card, but they've got like seven teams to jump. They've all those teams keep losing. Like, the wild card battle is a lot of teams doing like the Jays, hovering around 500, having bad weeks here and there. The Jays would only have to jump one additional team to get back in that wild card mix. What does that mean? Not necessarily now, because we know they're going to grind this out to the trade deadline, at least until after the All-Star break 5 weeks from now. But what's on the line here? What would maybe buying look like And hey, yeah, Kevin Biggio to the Dodgers for Braden Fisher. We'll break all that down with Ben Nicholson-Smith after the break. And then we'll talk to the Heartbreak Kid, Shawn Michaels, about his new-ish role with WWE and NXT, as well as the big WWE weekend coming up here in Toronto. All that's next as JStock Plus continues.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Again, 210 start today as Chris Bassett looks to secure a series victory for the Blue Jays against Tobias Myers and the Milwaukee Brewers. That would push the Blue Jays back to 500 and could get them as close as a game back of the wild card. 3-0 win yesterday. Very nice Yusei Kikuchi start around. A lot of nonsense from home plate umpire Quinn Wolcott and a bunch of trouble in the early innings. There, if you missed it, Kevin Kiermaier did leave that game banged up. Right knee contusion after fouling one off his knee. If he ends up needing an IL stint, Nathan Lucas is on the IL in AAA. So maybe it's an Addison Barger spot. A couple days ago, it probably would have been, Kevin Biggio's here. We could just call Spencer Horwitz up spot. But the Blue Jays obviously designated Kevin Biggio for assignment. And then today traded him to the Los Angeles Dodgers as our next guest broke first on Twitter. Couldn't possibly save it for live on the show because he had to beat Jeff Passan. It's Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet, of At The Letters. Good morning, man. How we doing?
Blake, doing well. Wish I could have saved it for the show. That would have been a fun little moment. But like you said, breaking news waits for no one.
It waits for nobody whatsoever. And at this point, look, we've digested a lot of the Kevin Biggio designated for assignment decision, why that happened over, say, a Daniel Vogelbach or an Ernie Clement. Some obviously opinions have varied on this a lot, as they have on Kevin Biggio generally over the years among the fan base and even media around the team. Now that we see the conclusion of this, what do you make of this landing spot for Kevin on a Dodgers team that is pretty good and a little lefty heavy, but obviously sees something here in Biggio as a bench piece?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think from the standpoint of Kevin Biggio, this is a great spot. The Dodgers, I don't have to tell anyone, they're one of the best teams in baseball. He gets to go there with Teoscar Hernandez, Shohei Ohtani. It's a great stadium. It's a great fan base. Yeah, I can think of a lot of worse places to go than the Los Angeles Dodgers. So I'm sure that Biggio will embrace what they ask of him, will probably deliver on it, and be a useful bench player. I mean, I think that he would have been a useful bench player anywhere, including Toronto. They obviously decided that they have other bench players that they prefer, which, hey, there are reasonable arguments to be made on that front as well. But I think for Biggio, this is a great landing spot.
Okay, so the Jays are getting back in this trade. Braden Fisher, who's kind of just an org depth reliever, 23 years old, was a decently high draft pick a few years back. But, the numbers haven't been great. He's very interesting from a pitch mix perspective, where he throws that curveball like 50% of the time and it's his best pitch, and the other stuff maybe doesn't play. But hey, who throws a curveball 50% of the time? Almost nobody. So he's a pretty fascinating guy. What's your read on Fisher? Just kind of get something for Kevin out the door. The other thing that should be said here is that by trading him, the $2 million and change or so, unless there's another detail still to come out, the $2 million and change or so the Jays would have owed Kevin Biggio is off the books as well.
Yeah, that's right. So it does seemingly free up a little bit of payroll. Not that that seems to be the limiting factor with the Jays at this point. But as for Fisher, it's interesting. Like you said, Blake, I mean, to see a guy throwing a curveball that often, it's interesting. There's no such thing as a relief prospect. So that applies here. This is not really a relief prospect. But, he's 91 to 94 with the fastball. He'll mix in a slider and a cutter as well. So yeah, he's someone who, you take a shot with him. You see what he can do in AAA as a reliever, and maybe that becomes something and maybe it doesn't. But once you DFA a player, as you know, your leverage is kind of shot. You're not exactly going to get a huge return.
Yes. You're just trying to get something back, really. And hey, an extra reliever for either for Buffalo or New Hampshire, it doesn't hurt, even if it's just to help fill innings. So, Ben, obviously this is the biggest trade the Blue Jays are going to make this year. This is it. This is their move. Since we last talked, and we have kind of danced around, not even danced around, we've just embraced and danced with this idea that if things kept going as they had a few weeks back, they were probably going to have to sell at the deadline, and that would have an eye on 2025 probably. They have not fixed things. They're 10-5, I think, since we had last had that conversation against an easier slate of schedule. But they are back within a game of 500. They are within two games of a wild card spot here because there are only like four or five good teams in baseball this year. Ben, at what point do we get to, because it's more fun, turn the page to, hey, this team could potentially be modest or light to modest buyers again, if things continue as they are.
Well, I'm glad we're talking about this now because this might be our one shot
yes.
all year.
That's why we're doing it. About,
yeah, and exactly. This is why I wanted to have this discussion, while we can, because I do think it's interesting. It's definitely way more fun to think about adding as opposed to subtracting for any major league team. And yeah, there are 1-6 week away from being right back in that sellers discussion. So I'm glad we're here considering it. I think here's the thing with a team that's been mediocre for the first 65 games of the season. It's apparent that they need rotation help, bullpen help, and offensive help. So there's literally any category that you can name the Blue Jays would need help there. Clearly, I mean, the starting rotation, it's a tough place to upgrade. But they don't have a fifth starter right now. We'll see what happens with Yuriel Rodriguez. Maybe he answers that. But you'd at least want to monitor that part of the market. Clearly, bullpen, especially from the left side. And then offense, too. I think it's pretty clear this group could use offensive upgrades. Even when they win, it's like 2-0.
Yeah, it feels a little bit like the Seinfeld bit with the naked guy on the subway of going through each aspect of the team and picking apart how bad it is and how much help they need. And then at the end being like, but you got to like their chances. They're only two games out of the wild card. But that is kind of how it is. So in terms of, let's focus on the position player side. So obviously there's some positional flexibility because they have, you could slot someone in third or second or left field, and any of those would make sense. Is power front of mind for you if we get to that point?
Yeah. You look at this team, Vladdy, Jansen, Davis Schneider, Varsho, you got a few guys who can hit for some power on this team. Bo should, but I'm not holding my breath on George Springer and Justin Turner providing this team with that power. So to some extent, what the next month and a bit gives you is a chance to assess what you have. So that is like Spencer Horwitz, Justin Turner, even Springer, not that they would move him, but what does his playing time look like as they move ahead here? If Turner still isn't hitting at the end of July, at that point, we're into take him off the roster territory. I know he's had a good week. We'll see where that leads. And then with Horwitz, he's also had a great week, but he's got to sustain that before you feel really confident that he can get you where you want to go. So you're in assessment mode for now. If they do get to, the end of July and there are a couple games over 500, at that point, they'll know a lot more about how those pieces fit and what things would look like. But to your original point, yeah, I think power makes a lot of sense.
Horwitz, by the way, leading off today. Vlad's got an off day, so the top of the lineup is Horwitz, Schneider, Bichette, Vogelbach. We'll go through the rest of that a little later. But that's certainly, I got asked earlier, like, why is Bo still hitting fourth? Or should this person move in the lineup? Should that person move in? And they happen all the time, and I get it. But the answer is they don't have enough good hitters. Like, no, there's no iteration of the lineup that would look good enough. So you mentioned potentially the fifth starter spot as well. And look, no team is going to love their starting pitching depth. The Brewers have an entire rotation worth of guys on the IL. I'm sure they didn't want to call up Carlos F. Rodriguez already. I'm sure they didn't expect to be relying on Tobias Myers, etc. But the Jays came into the year, and we thought that, not thought, the starting pitching depth was technically better than entering the season last year, but it wasn't great, right? There was, hey, maybe Alek Manoah can get back to where he was. Bowden Francis is probably best off as a long man, but we can start him if we need. Yariel Rodriguez is cool, but we're only going to let him throw about 100 innings the whole year. And then you got into, well, Wes Parsons and Paolo Espino are like, they technically exist and they're on the 40 man. And, I will continue to take the loss on thinking Mitch White was going to be a little better this year. That's better than it was the year prior, but this is still year two now of us being in kind of this exact same situation with the fifth starter spot. What do you make of that?
Well, it's not where you want to be, right? And I think back to 2015, right after Mark Shapiro took over and he was kind of taking stock of the organization. And he said at the time, in AAA, we have four guys named blank. And that's not where we want to be as an organization. You don't want to have a AAA rotation where no one there can really be called upon. And couple years or many years later, that's kind of where the Jays are. They don't really have someone in AAA that they're thrilled to call up or even that they're kind of okay calling up. We've seen Bowden Francis didn't really work out. Yariel Rodriguez eventually could be a major league starting pitcher. I'm really intrigued to see what he can do this weekend, just given that he struck out 10 of the 15 hitters he faced in his latest rehab assignment. But I'm not totally sure that, you know, he's stretched out to the point that he's the answer there. Then you look at the Buffalo rotation. It's Aaron Sanchez. You see a lot of TBA. And it's kind of that point where you don't have the depth organizationally to call up. And granted, it's a tough thing to do. It is not easy. Most teams at AAA don't have guys that they're just thrilled to call up. But if you're going to be one of the best teams in baseball, and clearly that's something that Jays aspire to, then you do want to have something more than those four guys named blank. And so to me, organizationally, this is a reflection of not developing enough pitching.
Yeah, and it's tough. You look around at some of the teams who have survived a lot of pitching injuries this year, and look, each of these cases is going to seem like a unique case on its own, but, you know, the Yankees found a lot, or they found something with Luis Gil, right? Like a guy who was flittering on the edges of, is he still going to be a prospect or is he a bullpen guy, is suddenly like, I don't know if he's still eligible, but if he is, he's going to be in the very strongly in the Rookie of the Year consideration. The Brewers have been able to, none of them are flashy, but look at the series, a couple pitchability guys, a Colin Ray, a Tobias Myers. We just saw, who was I going to mention? Albert Suarez for the Orioles, who has kind of come back from Korea and been a win there.
Povich.
This is, pardon me?
And Povich, they just called up.
Yeah. Yeah, and Povich, you know, who knows? He didn't look that great against the Blue Jays, but he's a guy. There are ways to do this, so it's something that hopefully they continue to address. Adam Mackle was just on the show, so I should mention that he's in the depth chart somewhere there as well, but probably, again, the guys that you do have and may be comfortable with or plan to have coming in this year, like Chad Dallas hasn't been good. He's going to need the full season at AAA. Adam Mackle, they probably don't want to rush this year. And then most of their pitching talent beyond that is concentrated at like A-ball and below, where we're talking about like 2026, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I do think that Mackle, I'm interested to go back and listen to that conversation, because he's arguably, I don't know, like the top pitching prospect in this organization at this point with
healthy.
Tiedemann on the shelf. Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, obviously Tiedemann has a ton of upside, but Mackle is worth watching. That's a nice silver lining to that Teoscar Swanson trade. But yeah, no one's saying it's easy. You know, every team in baseball is trying to do this. It's tough to develop pitching. It's tough to acquire it and to make it better. But hey, this is Major League Baseball. It's a tough league. It's a tough environment. It's extremely competitive. You're going up against Brian Cashman, Andrew Friedman, guys who are going to end up in the Hall of Fame someday. You're going up against Alex Anthopoulos. You're going up against the very best of what they do. So you have to find a way to join the top of that tier. You have to find a way to respond to that challenge. And what we're seeing right now, you know, you look at AAA, not seeing on the relief front too, mind you. So you're not seeing a ton of answers on the relief front or in the starting pitching front. You don't want to have a AAA team that isn't offering solutions to the Major League pitching staff. And I do think, to their credit, on the position player side, it's better. That's where Horwitz, he's helping. That makes a difference. Davis Schneider, too. Those are good things. But pitching is half the game, or, you know, it's a big part of the game. Maybe it's not quite half the game, but it is a big part of the game. You need to have support and reinforcements coming from the minors in a way that the Jays currently do not have.
So when it comes to, you know, your point about, hey, let's talk about them as potential buyers, because this might be the only window we get to play that out. The fact that the org is thin in the minor leagues, and especially at the higher levels, and the fact that, yes, despite things being a little bit better lately, they're still under 500. They're still two games out of a playoff spot. The run differential is still very, very bad. Like, this team has gotten back to okay. They have not gotten back to good. We should be very clear on. How hesitant do you think this front office would be to pull from that minor league system to add to a team that, yes, even when things have turned around, still just looks like they're fine?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It's a tough line to walk, right? Yeah, I think a lot of it will depend on the underlying performance of the major league team and, of course, the record. I do think that if you get there and you're a couple, say it's July 30th, you're a game and a half out of the third wild card, you're at 500, and you have 60 games to play, to me, even if your team is mediocre, I say go for it. I say try to win. And look, it can backfire, right? I had Jeff Fletcher, who covers the Angels, respond to a tweet of mine yesterday. And he pointed out that last year the Angels were a few games out. They went for it, right, to try to bolster around Shohei Ohtani. It completely backfired. And that's the downside. That is the risk. At the same time, you're in the business of trying to win games, right? You don't want to just not compete. Like, if this was an F1 race and you were 13th with, I don't know, 10 laps to go, like, are you going to just stop the car? Like, try to win. That's the point of this sport. So I lean that way, but it's a fine line. You're not going to be reckless when it comes to trading your prospects away.
Is there any scenario, do you think, then, where this middle ground they've kind of played their way into, it just ends up being like a bit of a dud of a July, where they're not, like, June could go really poorly, where in July, and look, they're going to grind it out to the trade deadline. Like, they've got 30 games before the All-Star break here. I think that's probably the earliest they decide to pull the plug and sell. Maybe it's the earliest they'd buy as well to really see what's here. But is there a scenario, and this is the worst scenario for us coverage-wise, this is the worst scenario for fans, it's probably the worst scenario competitively, where it's just like, we're 500 and we're two games out of a playoff spot. We can't justify selling when we're this close, but we're not good enough to justify adding. Like, is that kind of the fear that's where they end up on July 30th?
Yeah, I wouldn't cross that off the list of possibilities, right? I mean, in an underwhelming season, who's to say that the deadline can't also be underwhelming? Who knows which way it goes? I mean, it's way too far in the future to predict, but of course that's a possibility. And I think one thing worth keeping in mind, set aside the Jays here, let's just talk Major League Baseball for a second. You look at how the playoff race is now structured, six teams per league make it. That's a lot of teams. It's like almost half the league. It's almost NBA and NHL style right now. So many teams are in it. So you really don't have a lot of sellers. Even teams that we would think would be sellers, like maybe the Pirates or the Nationals, they're still kind of in it. The Tigers are still in it. So good luck trying to get Jack Flaherty from the Tigers. Like, you know, it's going to cost a ton, and the Tigers might not even trade him. And same with the Nationals. Like, you think you're getting Lane Thomas? They're not going to give him away. And how many good outfielders are there? I mean, Brent Rooker's going to be out there. You can acquire him, I'm sure, but he's controllable too. So the point being, the few players that are on non-contending teams that are actually desirable are going to have so much competition for them that it's going to be really hard to pull off a trade unless you are tipping it over the edge and giving up enough that you're probably feeling a little bit uncomfortable.
And we saw that last year, right? If anyone remembers last year's trade deadline, at least on the position player side, it was really underwhelming. The bats that we expected to move didn't expect to move. And this is kind of to give you everyone a picture of how the league is tiered right now. There are five teams on pace to win 100 games. There are five teams on pace to win 61 games. And then there are 20 teams on pace to win between 70 and 94. So, like, two-thirds of the league is within 10 games of 500 at the end of the year on either side. Like, I know that by the end of the year, that'll look like a 20 game swing between the top of those teams and the bottom of those teams, but it really is a tier one, a bottom tier, and then this huge, huge meaty middle. And yeah, we saw last, and look, some of these teams will shake out between now and the end of July. We'll add one or two sellers, we'll add one or two buyers. But I really do think, Ben, that we're still, like, as a baseball community, we're still recalibrating to the expanded playoff format and that, like, I don't know, just how there are going to be two teams in the American League who make the playoffs who wouldn't have made the playoffs before and don't look like playoff teams on paper, right?
Right. And I think, too, you know, last year, everyone points to the Arizona Diamondbacks, who made the World Series after winning 84 games. And, you know, that was pointed out as an exception. And there are certainly exceptional elements to it. But I don't think it's the last time we see an 84-win team make it through. Now, it's always going to be tough. You don't want to count on that. I don't think it's a good approach to hope to be an 84-win team, and that's kind of where the Blue Jays find themselves right now. Not a great place to be for a lot of reasons. One, you want to avoid the wild card game. Two, once you get there, if you're a better team, you're going to have a better chance of winning the successive three rounds, the DSCS and the World Series. So yeah, you want to have a really good team, but there's still this little sliver for more mediocre teams to get in, and because of the randomness of baseball, to do some damage.
Yeah, we don't want to go full Jerry DePoto with this, the Seattle Mariners executive who said the 10-year plan is to win 54% of the games every year, because like odds are you'll get in the playoffs a couple times, and you know then it's a crapshoot. You don't want to go like that. But yeah, you do have to recognize that, like, yeah, the Dodgers only have one World Series in 11 playoff appearances or whatever. Getting there is a big part of the battle here. Ben, as we look ahead to this game today, the series clincher here, and the rest of June, and really this weekend, like, that Cleveland team's really good. The Red Sox, six games against Red Sox are helpful for division standings and wildcard standings and stuff like that. But the Brewers and the Guardians are the teams with the really big records here. What are you looking for? Like, they split this two with the Brewers. They've been kind of low scoring playoff style games. I don't know that the Jays have it in them to, you know, we could say, oh, it'd be nice to get the bats going, but this, it kind of feels like this is going to be the formula for a while here, right? To grind out these kind of tighter ones against teams that are doing what you're trying to do a little better than you, like Milwaukee and Cleveland?
Yeah, I think that's a fair read. I mean, what I'll be looking for is just to see how some of these players that we've talked about perform. I mean, Horowitz, if he can keep this up, that's huge for the Jays. Davis Schneider's been in a slump. Can he get out of it? Justin Turner, it's been pretty rough since the start of May. What can he do? George Springer, you know, what is he doing to justify playing 6-7 days a week? Is he that guy for this team? You know, I think with Bichette, with Vladdy, those guys have performed well enough. You know, as I'm sure you've talked about, Bo for the last month has been really good. Vladdy having a great season. I mean, I know he only has 7 homers. This is a really good season for Vlad Guerrero Jr. So I'm not as dialed in on those guys and kind of wondering what's going to happen. I think they are where they should be for the most part. Same with someone like Varsho, same with someone like Jansen, and even Kirk has come around. But I'm watching offensively to see which guys are more building blocks. Vogelbach, too, is in this. I guess I'm mentioning the whole roster, but, you know, basically you want to see which guys are more deserving of continued playing time and continued at-bats at the top of the order, and which guys should be on the bench more often.
And those guys should feel that as well. And this is what, you know, one of the nice things about baseball is if you're worried about your own work and your own spot, that's still going to help the team win, because more guys on base, more runs coming in, all of that would be great. Ben Nicholson-Smith, you've been great. Thanks for taking the time out, man. I really appreciate it.
Anytime. Thanks, Blake.
Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet, of Sportsnet.ca. New episode of At the Letters up on that podcast feed as well. Quickly before we take a break and talk to the heartbreak kid, Shawn Michaels, it is Jays Brewers. It is 2:00 today. Chris Bassitt on the hill, 8 pitches, little bit of platoon splits, etc. The Orioles who have faced him haven't faced him recently, but those who have are 3-for-23 against them, the Brewers who are in the lineup today. That lineup, by the way, is Terán, Contreras, Yelich, Adames, Frelick, Bowers, Churio, Dunn, and Perkins. So getting a little youthful at the bottom third there. The Jays are going to line up as follows. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is getting the day off, surely available as a pinch hitter. Kevin Kiermaier, also not in there today, whether that's a matchup thing or related to the knee contusion he suffered yesterday, not immediately clear. But Spencer Horwitz will lead off. Davis Schneider will hit second. Bo Bichette third. Daniel Vogelbach fourth. So new look at the top of the order there with no Vlad in there and no Jansen in there. Horwitz, Schneider, Bichette, Vogelbach, Springer, Kirk, Varsho, Kiner Falefa, and Ernie Clement rounds it out. None of these Blue Jays have ever seen Tobias Myers before, but you've heard the Tobias Myers breakdown because it's similar to the Hogan Harris breakdown. It's similar to the Colin Ray breakdown. It's similar to the Carlos Rodriguez breakdown. He throws 6 different pitches, 5 really. There is a sinker that he's toyed with, but he'll throw 5 different pitches. The curveball is the only one that doesn't get a ton of, or that gets a good amount of swing and miss, but he, or sorry, the changeup is the one that gets a bunch of swing and miss. He'll only throw at the lefties though. The fastball is not that intimidating at 92, 93, doesn't get a lot of swing and miss, but you've heard this before too, throws it up in the zone a lot, etc. So you know the book on Tobias Myers, even if you haven't seen Tobias Myers yet. That's probably it for Jays Talk on Jays Talk Plus today. We're going to take a break. On the other side, we're going to talk to Shawn Michaels, the heartbreak kid, WWE Hall of Famer. Couldn't be more excited, but this might be it for your Jays Talk for today on Jays Talk Plus. Shawn Michaels next as we continue on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Shawn Michaels will be joining us in a couple minutes here. You do have a Blue Jays afternoon game to get ready for. 210, Chris Bassitt against Tobias Myers. We went over the lineups with you before that last break. Make sure you're tuned in early, though. It is a 2 p.m. game. Dan, Joe, and Hazel on the TV side. Ben and Chris on the radio side. Jamie and Caleb in Blue Jays Central. And Shai Davidi on the ground there covering for us for sportsnet.ca. Yeah, a little off day for Vlad. Spencer Horwitz and David Schneider at the top of the order. Bo Vogelbach Springer through the middle of the order. It's a look. But this is where the Blue Jays lineup is at right now. By the way, the reason we're talking to Shawn Michaels today, other than anytime you can get a chance to talk to Shawn Michaels and you're a big wrestling guy, you talk to Shawn Michaels, is that WWE has a very big weekend here coming up. And obviously, we're a WWE partner at Sportsnet. You can tune into Sportsnet to watch your WWE programming every week, whether it's Monday Night Raw, NXT on Tuesdays, SmackDown on Fridays, and then Sportsnet Plus for premium live events. Well, there is one of those coming. Money in the Bank is here the first weekend in July. That is SmackDown on Friday, July the 5th. Money in the Bank, the premium live event on July the 6th, which if you aren't familiar, has a lot of ladder matches. So lots of plunder, lots of fun for that one. And then NXT Heatwave is on July 7th on the Sunday. All of those at Scotiabank Arena. Tickets are on sale now and available at Ticketmaster. So yeah, should be a pretty fun weekend. You guys know, I think most of you know that I am a wrestling guy. I do a little bit of wrestling stuff on the side as well. Some play-by-play commentary for Smash Wrestling, who are also here in Toronto on June 30th down at the Rec Room. I'll be commentating that one as well. And WWE is doing some interesting things right now. There are some crossover things they're doing with other organizations. So we've seen TNA Impact wrestlers pop up on WWE and NXT recently. It makes it very, very interesting to see who might pop up and how those roster trades might go. While we wait for Shawn Michaels to join us, we'll take a look at some texts in the text line as well. 590, 590. You can always keep those coming, and we'll try to tee this game up for you. So again, it's Chris Bassitt against Tobias Myers. Tobias Myers, something to know. So I kind of gave the rundown. He throws five or six different pitches. None of them are super elite. The changeup's pretty good, but he'll only throw with the lefties, and the Jays don't have a lot of lefties in the lineup, so it might not come up all that much. But one thing he does really, really well, and this could be a good formula against a Blue Jays team that at times this year has sat back and wanted to see pitches and been a little passive early in counts. Tobias Myers throws a first pitch almost 70% of the time, which is near the top of the league among all starters. He also, that fastball I talked about, it's only 92 or 93, but it has one of the highest active spin rates in all of baseball, which again, we're looking at that kind of rising. And when we say active spin, that means the kind of front spin rather than the gyro spin, which is kind of more sideways. So one of the highest spin fastballs in the league, which gives it that kind of rising feel. And it looks like it's kind of coming up out of his hand. Hitters are hitting just 177 against it. And it's been his number two pitch by run value, the changeup being his top one. So we'll see how that goes. Again, none of these Jays have ever faced him, and the Jays have not done super, super well with this kind of lower velocity, high in the zone, high spin fastball type. Now, having said that, the Jays haven't done well with a lot of different pitcher types, which is kind of what Joe Siddle said to us yesterday on the show. So yeah, we'll see how it goes with Tobias Myers. Maybe seeing a handful of these guys in a row helps. I'm not super optimistic about that, but the bar is pretty low in terms of being able to put some offense on the board and win a game as a result of that. The Jays are 32-10 when they score three runs or more. Now, league-wide, the winning percentage is almost 680. So this is the weird offensive environment we're in, where the OPS league-wide is down to 698, which we've talked about. Run scoring is down. Home runs are down. So if you just score three runs in a game, league-wide, three or more runs, you're winning almost 68% of the time. That is surprising to hear that number. Now, the Jays are doing well in those situations. They have the number six win-loss record when they do score three or more. They have, of course, scored zero or one 15 times this year. So that is that's not particularly strong here. So, the bar is pretty low. You got to get to three runs, and if you can get to three runs, you're in pretty good shape to win a game. That's probably true with Chris Bassitt on the mound, maybe a little less so with how the Blue Jays bullpen has been overall in the season, but they've certainly trended in the right direction despite the injury to Jordan Romano and Eric Swanson being down in the minor leagues. Again, you can send us your text to 590-590. Not sure when we'll get HBK here. But yeah, the Chris Bassett side of this matchup is pretty straightforward. He has seen some of these guys, but none in the last year and a half. Again, very poor results for the four Brewers who have seen him. The one thing to note, of course, as always with Chris Bassett, is there are pretty extreme platoon splits going on right now from both a hit and a power perspective. Against lefties, he's been going sinker, cutter, curve, splitter, and then mixing in the other four pitches, whereas against righties, it's much heavier on the sinker. Against lefties, he kind of goes sinker, cutter, curve, and then against righties, it's sinker, and then a big gap, and the cutter and the curve, and then he'll sprinkle in the sweeper and the change there. He also has one of the biggest velocity differences in the league, actually the biggest velocity difference in the league between his fastball and his curveball. Bowden Francis is number two. So that's an interesting thing to watch there. The second time the Brewers will get a look. Shawn Michaels is going to join us in a minute here. So we're pretty much wrapped on Blue Jays talk for the day. Again, it's 2:10 start. We'll be back with you tomorrow at 10 a.m. to break down this one and set up the series with the Guardians as well. There was one. Yeah, Patton Brampton had asked, by the way, we had Adam Mackle on the show earlier, if Adam Mackle could be a starter for this team next year. I think that's the hope. He's doing really well in Double A right now. You hope he gets to Triple A by the end of the season. And then, yeah, it's in the mix for 2025. That's maybe a little aggressive relative to where he was at this time last year. But when you pitch effectively and you have strong results at the Double A level, that's the kind of conversation that starts happening. And it should be noted, too, that around the league, you know, teams are generally pretty aggressive promoting right from Double A with their pitching prospects. And some of that has to do with the Triple A run environment being so hitter friendly, and you maybe don't want to expose your guys to that necessarily. But also just there's the biggest jump is to the majors. So whether you're coming out of Double A or Triple A, and that's a weird thing to say, obviously, if the jump's big, you would probably want them to get Triple A reps. But what we're seeing around the league is that teams are pretty comfortable with some pitching prospects going Double A to the majors. I think in the case of Mackle, they'd probably want to get him some Triple A reps first, especially given that he's still, you know, this is only 50, 60 innings of Double A as well. Phil and Peterborough, asked, anything stand out about Danny Jansen regressing a bit at the plate? Not really. It's just kind of, he was hitting so far above. And look, Danny Jansen's a good hitter. He's been one of the best hitting catchers in baseball over the last couple of years when healthy. But I did not think he was going to sustain hitting like Juan Soto and Shohei Ohtani. So some of this is just natural regression. He's continuing to make pretty good contact with the ball. The chase rate is still down pretty good. He's been barreling them up a little bit less and maybe getting a little less loft because of that, like trading in some fly balls for line drives. And we know that Danny Jansen, when he's going, is kind of a dead pull hitter. So maybe there's something in that. But, you know, in looking into it, it's mostly looked like, yeah, he's a catcher who's been playing a lot and was hitting a little bit over his head. So that was just kind of natural to come back down a little bit. Frank and Kitchener, more batting order questions today. People love Chad in the batting order. Where should Turner hit in the batting order? I don't have a good answer for that because on merit, Turner would only be starting probably against left-handed pitching, which is the case today. He's not starting against the righty. Probably in the like 6-7 part of the order because you're not going to put Justin Turner down 8-9. They're just not going to do it. But his stick has not warranted being much higher than that. Now, having said that, against lefties, I'd probably still have him in one of those power positions, whether it's 4 or 5, depending on who else you have in the lineup in a game like that. So someone who didn't sign asked me to rank my top 5 wrestling themes. That is a good question because we're going to have Shawn Michaels on shortly. I will say Shawn Michaels is in there. Edge, the You Think You Know Me Metalingus theme is, I think, at the tippy top of that list. Then you get into some like, is this a good actual song? Is this a good wrestling song, et cetera? So we'll fill out that list a little bit. And someone else asked me to ask HBK when they're coming back to the Maritimes. I don't think I'll put them on the spot for that one. But yeah, it'd be great to see a, maybe not a PLE, maybe just a house show out at St. John's or something like that. We'll be joined by Shawn Michaels in a minute here. And the reason we were able to get to talk to Shawn Michaels today is because NXT Heatwave is here on July 7th at Scotiabank Arena. SmackDown is here on that Friday, July the 5th. Money in the Bank is here on the Saturday, July the 6th. Tickets to all of those are on sale now, available at Ticketmaster. You can find more with the hashtag WWE Toronto. And as always, you can tune into Sportsnet to watch Raw on Monday, NXT on Tuesday, SmackDown on Friday, and Sportsnet Plus for all your premium live event viewing. You can go to sportsnetplus.ca/WWE to subscribe. For anyone who doesn't know, in addition to being an in-ring Hall of Famer, Shawn Michaels has transitioned into a role as Senior Vice President of Talent Development Creative for WWE and NXT, which, you know, means he has a hand in the kind of next wave of talent coming into WWE, coming into pro wrestling. We're just getting set up with Shawn. We'll have Shawn Michaels on in just a second. It's a pretty interesting time for the WWE and NXT. And again, we'll focus on NXT because that's where Shawn Michaels' focus is. And they're having, you know, pretty good moment here. I watched NXT Battleground, which is their premium live event, on the weekend to kind of check out where the product is at and the work they're doing. And it's pretty fun. I mentioned earlier they're doing crossovers with other wrestling promotions like TNA Impact to freshen up the roster and give us some new matches and things like that. Also, I gotta say, the NXT women's division is like the deepest women's division in wrestling. So if you're a fan of women's wrestling, if that's something you're interested in, Shawn Michaels and the NXT crew have done a terrific job of building that up. Also, a lot of good social media crossover. Sexy Red, if you know that musician, hosted on the weekend. Ahmed, I'm not answering your question because I'm waiting for Shawn Michaels to join. And if I had a wrestling walkout song, I would have a customized wrestling walkout song. I'm not going to pick someone else's walkout song. Come on, man. I'm not doing that. I'm not picking out someone else's wrestling theme to enter to the ring to. Anyway, so that weekend should be a lot of fun here. I know we'll be doing some stuff around it at Sportsnet in addition to having all of those things on Sportsnet Plus and the weekly shows on Sportsnet. So again, NXT Heatwave on July 7th at Scotiabank Arena, part of Money in the Bank weekend. Shawn Michaels, the Senior Vice President of Talent Development Creative at WWE, joins us now. Shawn, thanks for doing this, man. This is a pleasure. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Okay, Shawn, so you're doing... coming out of NXT Battleground on the weekend, you're twerking with Sexy Red, you're doing TikToks, you're doing the chef memes. How much fun are you having in your role right now?
I'm having a great deal of fun. Obviously, some of it is, I think, scarring the youth of the NXT locker room. But other than that, the social team seems to be having a lot of fun with me. I'm just doing my best to, I don't know, to not do anything too stupid, but, you know, my children are already used to being embarrassed by their father. So, you know, I may continue that as we get down the road.
I'm sure the young talent, I'm sure it means a lot to them, given what you've meant to the wrestling industry and the role you're playing now with WWE. Have you reflected a lot on, you know, where you are and why, like, why do you think that the developmental side, finding these next level of talents, helping them develop their characters and things like that, why that has been where you've gravitated after your in-ring career?
Well, honestly, it's like everything in my life. I haven't tried or forced a lot of things to happen. I've sort of just gone where I feel like I've found the most joy or enjoyment out of what I do. And again, I told the story before. You know, we came down here on a vacation with the family, you know, from Texas, and you know, going to Disney World and stuff like that, visiting friends. And then I swung by the Performance Center and just the vibe in the building. And I don't know, something that had not been in my heart for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years after I retired, just sprung back up again. And it was something that I came back, I shared it with my wife, and she looked at me and she said, okay, that's the look. She said, I know what's going on. She said, I got to be honest. She said, I didn't think it would take this long. She said, I was surprised that you were, I don't know, that you walked away so easily. And she said, you know, look, you want to pack up and move to Texas? I'm on board. That's just sort of how to, you know, look, that's the same way I married this woman, same way I got into this job. I sort of just looked at stuff and said, that's what makes me happy. And I've gone ahead and given it a shot. And this was the same way. Came in here, you know, in a pair of shorts, flip-flops, and a tank top, said I'd never wear a headset, said I'd never wear a sports coat. And here I am 8 years later wearing headsets and obviously dressed like I am. And clearly when I talk a bunch of smack, you probably shouldn't listen to me because who knows what the future holds.
At least you still got the hat though, right? You're putting the Shawn Michaels spin on it still.
Well, I got to keep the brand alive a little bit.
Well, look, how much fun you guys are having with it really comes off in the product. NXT Battleground this past weekend, watched it on Sportsnet Plus. A lot of fun. I know that you guys have been kind of building this momentum generally. I specifically noticed it with the women's division, where you guys have this very deep women's division. You even introduced a second individual women's title with the North American Championship on the weekend. What do you think it is that's clicked so well for that women's division for you guys of late?
Well, from the very beginning, from the recruiting process, I don't know any other way to say it, but just so many stud athletes out there. I don't want to create a competition, I guess, or a negative one with the men or anything. But again, it's just amazing. Some of the extremely athletic and talented women that are out there how quickly they're adjusting and adapting to learning this, if it's something that they haven't watched a lot or grown up with. And it's one of those things, again, that has, you know, it's a word that gets tossed around, but it's true, has just happened organically. And clearly our women, as are all women, are on the same level as the men. And it was only fitting that we have a North American men's champion. We should have a North American women's champion. And clearly NXT has the depth of a roster that can sustain that. So for me, it was an easy call. And again, very proud of not just our women's division, but again, of all of our women that come through here in NXT. And like I said, just to the plethora, as they say, of college athletes that are out there, and how quickly they're transitioning into this line of work here is nothing short of amazing. So as great of a job as our coaches do and that we do here in NXT, I certainly want to give some credit to the recruiting team and the recruiting process, and clearly the athletes that are coming in here focused and ready to go.
Yeah, it seems to make a lot of sense. Target college athletes who have the athleticism, see who gets the personality going and wrestling clicks with. So Kalani Jordan won that North American Women's Championship in a ladder match. You guys are coming here in a couple of weeks for Money in the Bank weekend, which will have a couple of ladder matches. Sean, I know that you have had a lot of influence on the current product from an in-ring perspective. Does the ladder match still kind of hold something special for you, given that you and Razor Ramon way back kind of introduced that to the wrestling world, at least in North America?
Well, obviously, yeah, I'll say this. I don't think, Scott and I, when we went in there that first time, certainly from a pay-per-view standpoint, or even Brett and I, having the very first one, I don't think anybody in that time thought that it would become everything that it's become. I think, look, back then we just went out there, tried to have the best match that we could. This was a new concept at the time. Very proud that I feel like, those matches still kind of stand the test of time, being the original ones. But I don't know, like that's something like you even have to ask Brett. I don't know that, it was something that he felt like would all of a sudden become as big as it has become. But clearly, phenomenal concept. And I think, like I said, like with everything with the WWE, they've made it bigger and better and more extravagant than clearly I think were the original plans.
So you mentioned Brett there, and obviously everyone knows your history with Montreal and things like that, but you guys are coming here to Toronto. Again, it's July 5th, 6th, and 7th here at Scotiabank Arena. Do you have any memories from your career? Like, any highlights from wrestling in Toronto or wrestling in Canada that really stand out to you?
Well, again, I got asked this question earlier, and it sounds like it'll probably, I think, to fans sound like a small, insignificant thing, but it was just something that I always enjoyed and was unique, is that Toronto, again, was the only place that I could remember at that time when I first started going that had the walk all the way to the ring that was level with the ring when you came out. And I always thought that was a unique and different aspect of Toronto. And for me as a performer, it added an extra element every time we went there that I could sort of work with. And again, so for me, it was about that straight walkway that you guys had go into the ring that was level with the ring, that I always thought was unique. And like I said, something that came in handy if I needed to be, you know, taking some cool bumps somewhere.
Okay, so you guys are coming here. It's NXT Heat Wave. It's part of the Money in the Bank weekend, and the Heat Wave event will be on Sunday, July the 7th. I know we're early. We don't know any of the matches. I know you guys set up some stuff last night, and Cody Rhodes reveals that Trick Williams' challenger for the NXT Championship will be determined next week in a Battle Royal. And you guys just had Jordan Grace come in from TNA. Ash by Elegance came back. There have been some hints about maybe a Joe Hendry coming in and things like that. How exciting a time is it for you guys that this is a possibility? You can mix in some Joshis from Stardom. You can look at the TNA roster. Shayna Baszler can do the battle sports stuff at WrestleMania. How much has that opened up for you guys, and how much fun are you having with it?
Well, certainly, you can see that opens up, you know, numerous possibilities. I will say that I think there's some, there's probably more possibilities out there in the minds of other people than we actually are really sort of at this point, you know, possibly having. But again, thrilled about the, you know, the partnership that we had with, you know, and have with TNA. Obviously, looking forward to more of that in the future. But I also say at the same time, there's still a lot of things in the process. My focus for right now is obviously on NXT and obviously coming to Toronto on July 7th for NXT Heat Wave. And again, putting together just a hell of a card for the folks in Canada, because for a lot of our talent here, it'll be their first time coming to Canada. It's a really big, obviously, WWE weekend. They're always jazzed and excited about that. So again, I think it's going to be a fantastic weekend for Toronto. When NXT gets up there, they're going to have a blast going out there performing for y'all.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. Should be a lot of fun. Quick one for you before I let you go here, Sean. Who is some? I'd imagine a lot of these young guys are like, and girls are like, oh, it would have been so cool. I would love to work with Shawn Michaels. When you look at your career, whether it's someone now or someone from when you were active in the ring, someone you didn't get to work with that you would have really liked to have worked with if the timing lined up. Is there anyone that stands out like that for you?
Yeah, again, there are a lot of people, honestly, that after I left, it's one of those things that you always, you know, you think to yourself, my goodness, if I were 20 years younger, 10 years younger, now 30 years younger, you know, that you see it. And again, all for different reasons. You look at Seth Rollins, again, you know, even a guy like CM Punk, you know, Johnny Gargano, Tommaso Ciampa, guys that I've, you know, I don't know, because I got to coach them, that, you know, you think about having matches with. Logan Paul's the guy that's, you know, very special. Feel like he'd go out there and, you know, sell my tail off for a guy like Gunter. So for me, yeah, there's a lot of potential out there with people. But again, very, very happy that my time is, you know, is past, and looking forward to helping the folks in the future.
And you've mostly kept yourself off screen in NXT. Is that a conscious decision of just like, don't make the focus on Shawn Michaels, or you just don't want to be on camera anymore?
Yeah, honestly, it's a little of both, quite honestly. Look, this is, you know, NXT is about the future. And again, very happy and proud of the career that I got to have, but it is not about me anymore. Certainly want to help where I can. And if from a, you know, a television standpoint, there's somewhere that I can be helpful in that respect, that's great. But it is, yeah, it's mostly about focusing on the future and the talent in NXT.
Well, Sean, thanks so much for taking the time out. You guys are doing a great job. The product has been a lot of fun, and I'm really looking forward to Money in the Bank weekend and NXT Heatwave on July 7th.
Thank you very much. Appreciate y'all having me, and thanks for helping us out on this weekend.
Shawn Michaels, Senior Vice President of Talent Development and Creative at WWE and NXT. Had a million more questions for him, but tight on time there again. That is Money in the Bank weekend. SmackDown on the Friday, July 5th. Money in the Bank on the Saturday, July 6th. And NXT Heatwave on the Sunday, July 7th. All of those are at Scotiabank Arena. Tickets are on sale now, available at Ticketmaster. You can find more information with the hashtag WWE Toronto. And yeah, as usual, you can tune into Sportsnet to watch WWE programming every week. Monday Night Raw, NXT on Tuesdays, SmackDown on Fridays. You can stream NXT, SmackDown, and Money in the Bank on Sportsnet Plus. You can visit sportsnetplus.ca/WWE for more information about that. What a treat to get to talk to the Heartbreak Kid, Shawn Michaels. Now you get a 2 p.m. treat, Chris Bassett against Tobias Myers in an afternoon game, a getaway day game, a series rubber match to decide who takes two or three. The Jays with a chance to get back to 500 at 34-34, which would then give them the chance to get over 500, which is something you'd really like to do as you keep your eyes on the playoffs. Only two game out of the wild card here. Dan, Joe, and Hazel coming up for you on the TV side. Ben and Chris on the radio side. The Jeff Merrick Show is coming up next, but Blair and Barker have you for even more for Jays Talk postgame. Thank you to Adam Macko for coming on, Ben Nicholson-Smith, and the Heartbreak Kid, Shawn Michaels. Thanks to Lance, Ahmet, and Jennifer behind the glass. As always, thank you to you, and we will talk to you at 10 a.m. tomorrow.